ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So today's subject is a glance at Vedic civilization. Now when you discuss this subject, the Vedas, many other related ideas will crowd in our mind. The Sanskrit language, the great revolution that took place in European Indology from 18th century onwards, when they discovered the Sanskrit language, when they discovered a language which they later found out to be the original root language of all languages which are now known as the Indo-European family of languages, including Latin, Greek, and except of course the Hebraic languages. So that's what we talk about in the modern academic context in modern times, the Vedas. But what I'm going to present before you is not philology or its relationship with European languages. What I'm going to discuss right now is the very concept of secular life, family life, married life, human relations within the family structure that existed at a time in an age that's prehistoric, that may belong to around 4000 BC. And you are struck with wonder at some of these high sublime values of the institution of family life, the sanctity of the institution of marriage, just the relationship between parents and their children. So these are some of the areas which I am going to discuss right now. So as a prelude, I would say a few things about Vedas proper. Now Vedas are fourfold in number: Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda and Atharva Veda. Of these four Vedas, Rig Veda is the oldest and also the largest and the most voluminous. Each of these Vedas has four major divisions, the one dealing with rituals, the another dealing with prayers, the third one dealing with contemplative prayers, and the last one, which we call Vedanta, the higher metaphysical spiritual philosophy, which is at the back of the organization of the Ramakrishna Mission, or also Vedanta Society, which Vivekananda gave a new interpretation 19th century after visiting the United States in 1893, attending the Parliament of Religion. So these are four divisions. And you should remember that Vedas were never actually written as a single text. You'd be surprised to know it did not have a standardized version till the middle of 19th century. And it was a German Indologist, Max Müller, who happened to be commissioned by the Church of England. That's what they say. The letter still is kept in the museum library by the Church of England to translate Vedas and make it accessible to Hindus in India, so that Hindus will understand what absolute nonsense the Vedas are, and they will be willing to convert to Christianity. So this was a great commission that Max Müller had undertaken. But when he had not read a few pages before he became a convert to the Vedas. We have published, the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture has published a well-known, a very voluminous work on Max Müller. So that's part of the history. The letter is still being preserved as a document. And not only Max Muller, the 19th century Indologist like Paul Deussen and many others actually became not just students of Vedas, devotees of the Vedas. Can you imagine such a thing? You go to Egypt, you may learn Egyptology, you may learn hieroglyphics, you may study about the pyramids and the mummies, but you don't become a devotee of the pyramids, I believe. You may become a researcher in ancient Egyptian history. But Max Muller, Paul Deussen, Duperow, Hendrik, Ruth, Colebrook, Vindernitz, MacDonald, and in 20th century, many others became actually devotees of the Vedas. That's because Vedas do not talk about a single national culture, a single civilization, or a group of people. Vedas talk about human life in general, in all its multiple aspects. Well, coming back to Rig Veda Samhita, which is the most important of the four Vedas, just a few words. It is divided into 10 sections called mandalas, each mandala. And each of these mandalas are divided into several suktas. A sukta means, it is not sutra, yoga sutra, which you are familiar with. It is sukta, which is a long hymn, which may have just a few verses or may have 190 verses, like the Aigamatya Sukta or last Sukta of the Rigveda Samhita is more than 90 verses. So it contains 1087 suktas, at least according to the standardized version. And to be more precise, it contains more than 11,000 verses divided into 1087 suktas, and that again classified into 10 mandalas. It begins with Agnimile Purohitam Yajnasudeva Murticham Hotaram Ratnadhatamam. It means we pray to the fire god, means the effulgence. Because in ancient times, these Vedic Aryans, when I mention the word Aryan, that also needs some explanation, which I'm going to do very, very soon. These Vedic Aryans used to worship different deities, different feminine and masculine deities, of which Agni was one of the most important. So Agni was considered to be the one who takes your offerings to all other deities. So he was known as Purohita. You know, Purohita means the one who walks in front of you, the one who guides you, the one who takes your offering to different deities. So, that is Agnimile Purohitam. Agni, we propitiate, we bow down before Agni, who is the one, Yajna Vahakaha, that is the meaning given by Sayana, who wrote an elaborate commentary to entire Vedic literature in around 14th century. So, and it ends with Yatha Susavahasadi, and it ends with the concept of human unity, oneness and unity of the whole human existence. Aigamakya Suktam. The hymn of unity, the hymn of oneness or unity of human society. Okay, now, another aspect of this Rigveda Samhita is that it contains various aspects, various conceptions of God, the absolute reality. And it was Max Muller who, for the first time, using European or Western methodology of analyzing the evolution of Godhead in Rigveda Samhita, which is not fully accepted by the traditional scholars in India, including myself, happened to be one of them actually, you know, who studied right from my early childhood. But then it was a great contribution that Max Muller did to Vedic studies in Europe. And he says there are 5 or 6 different levels in the evolution of Godhead in Rigveda Samhita. Beginning with pantheism, you may be familiar, those who have read Emerson's works may be familiar with pantheism. Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, there are examples of pantheistic ideas in modern creative romantic poetry of 19th century Europe. England, of course. So, Pantheism is one, then panentheism. Pantheism implies you equate this beautiful, grand, sublime, phenomenal world to God. Wonderful rivers, huge rivers, mountains, valleys, and clouds, and vast sky. All these together are equated to one universal divine reality. It is the first human attempt to think of something transcendental. There is a mighty river or ocean, but behind this ocean, there should be a great creative intelligence who may be controlling and regulating. So inside and within, immanent in all of this, there should be one spirit. It's called panentheism, the next stage in the evolution of Godhead. The third stage is polytheism. You find, he says, behind everything that is sublime in nature, there should be a divine hand controlling, regulating, and guiding. You have to remember, all this happened long before men simplified the whole business. You can say one God is sitting there after working hard, creating this world, and he's taking rest now. You pray to him, and he does everything for you, and he does thinking for you. So one difficult thing for all of us to do is to think, you know. We can do physical work, but if somebody else can do the thinking on our behalf, it's very comfortable. So this mighty big man with a long beard sitting above the clouds worked hard, created this world, and is sitting aside somewhere, supervising with a no-nonsense expression on his face, with a long list of do's and don'ts, with a wonderful place where he may push you if you don't behave. Now, this is a very simple thing, but Vedic seers had a much more profound concept of the absolute reality. They didn't want a big no-nonsense dictator sitting above the clouds watching us closely. They wanted a much more intelligent concept of the absolute reality. So they said, well, this universal, beautiful, sublime nature itself is God. Or behind this, there is a divine presence called panentheism. The third stage in the evolution was polytheism, which tells you in short that behind the river, there's a river god, Varuna. Behind the air, there is an air god, Marut. And behind the fire, there is one god, the fire god, Agni. Behind the clouds, like that, behind everything that is grand, sublime, and powerful, and beautiful, there is a divine presence. It's called polytheism. Many gods and goddesses. And at a still higher level, they thought that there should be a big man who controls all these gods and who are his subordinates. It's called monotheism. All Abrahamic religions have reached this level of evolution where there's a wonderful, great, compassionate God who is very happy. Popular Hinduism, Vishnu, Shiva, all these are examples. Go to any temple, you find a very powerful man sitting there, and people pray to him, and he looks after all your needs, and also they think on your behalf. That's much more difficult thing to do. So we leave the whole responsibility to him. We pay little money. This happens in all traditions. You go to a place, pray once a week, and you can have your license renewed. Now, beyond this, there is a henotheism, which is actually first step towards monism. And the fifth stage is monism, where the thought of an absolute reality that is impersonal, attributeless, cannot be defined or described or explained, but can be experienced within our own hearts if we live a pure life, if we practice unselfishness, purity of life, look, be compassionate, be friendly, love your neighbor. Not because God will punish you, but because your neighbor and you are the same. Now, this is the highest concept of Godhead actually presented in the Rig Veda Samhita according to Max Muller. And he made a very great contribution because that gave a very wonderful idea of the evolution of Godhead in the Rig Veda Samhita. Remember, it doesn't really mean that there is a gradual evolution from first section to the 10th section. If we go to our old temple on the Filbert Street, you will find one inscription. The inscription is this: Ekam Sat Vipra Bhagudha Vadanti. It comes in the first section. That's important. So the ideas did not take a chronological evolution in the Rig Veda Samhita. Sometimes in the beginning itself, you find the highest concept presented, and to the end you find some of the more primitive ideas of God. So what I mean to say, this is the picture of the idea of Godhead in Vedic civilization. Now I mentioned something very important, Aryan. So you find, if you read any book on Rig Veda, the translations of Rig Veda, you come across the word Aryan, pronounced in modern English, Aryan, whatever it may be. Now, the word Aryan has a definite, well-structured meaning according to Vedic scholars. So the dictionary, the first dictionary that gave the meanings of these Vedic statements were Yaska's Niruktam, which goes to 9th century BC. And another dictionary, which was written around 2nd century AD, it says, Mahakula Kulinari Sadbis Sajjana Sadhavaha Aryaha. Who is an Aryan? Aryan is a person who is noble, who is compassionate, and who belongs to a noble, cultured hierarchy. And who is a sajjana, means a person of sattvic tendencies, established in truthfulness, non-violence, freedom from greed, all these ethical, spiritual qualities, if you find in a person, and if that person has a pedigree, a hierarchy, a cultural heritage, that person is called a Aryan. That's a real meaning of the word Arya in the Vedic tradition. That I want to emphasize, because that term unfortunately got monstrous connotations in 20th century, which I'm not going into details into. Now, something very special about the Vedic civilization was this. You know, the Vedic culture has one very interesting aspect about it. They did not believe that these Vedas were revealed to a single individual by God. If you think about Vedas and their relationship with Hinduism, you find Vedas constitute the fundamental canonical literature of Hindu culture, Hindu philosophy, Hindu spirituality. But these Vedas were not revealed by a god or a series of number of gods and goddesses through an anthropomorphic revealer and messenger. Great sages and saints who lived pure life, who practiced highest ethical moral values, meditated and contemplated. And as a result of these great spiritual truths, which are mentioned in the Upanishads, like the universality, the oneness, and the unity of the whole creation, the idea that God as a divine reality is present within all of us, and that God as a universal spiritual divine principle is present everywhere. So this universality and the idea of spiritual and philosophical oneness and unity of existence, this great spiritual truth was not revealed through a messenger to be spread and propagated among the rest of humanity. Rather, great saints and sages who contemplated and meditated, they felt these truths to be real in their own hearts. I can mention one of the most fundamental ideas given in the 10th section of Rig Veda Samhita, called Srishti Suktam, Nasadiya Suktam. It begins with Nasadasid, Nosadasid. So, Nasadasid, No sadasi means in the beginning there were neither non-existence nor existence. In the empirical language, there was something which cannot be called or limited by the expressions of existence or non-existence, which is beyond definition, beyond explanation, but which can be experienced as the divine reality present in our own hearts. So, sado bandhum asadi niravindan hrithi pradishya kavayo manisha. The great sages meditated, contemplated, lived a pure life, practiced non-violence, purity, truthfulness, all the great spiritual and ethical values. And finally, they realized the presence of that divine truth. Hrithi means hrithayaguhayam, in their own inner heart. They realized this truth. So, anyone can be a prophet. If you read Vivekananda's works, lectures, sometimes you are struck by some very, very revolutionary statements. He says, you can be a Buddha if you want. He says, Swamiji says, this moment, this day. You know what it means? It is not an exaggeration. What it says is, if you live a pure life, anyone can become divine by realizing the presence of that divine principle in his own or her own heart. He doesn't or she doesn't need a prophet or a messenger to reveal this to you, because God doesn't require a postman to send these letters to you. He will deliver to you right to your own doorsteps. If you live a pure life, the reality of God can be realized by any person irrespective of this. Now you remember, I don't mean to say that the whole of Hinduism accepts this. What I mean to say is the highest reach of Hindu philosophy called Vedanta. That's what I'm talking about here now. According to Vedanta, the highest spiritual and philosophical reach of Vedic literature tells you that anyone can realize the presence of God or this divine reality in his own or her own heart by living a pure life. Now, leave that behind. I'm just going to give you or quote for you a convocation address from an ancient Vedic literature. Students, both girls and boys, used to receive Vedic education in ancient India. So in course of time, when I deal with the education in Vedic times, I should quote those verses from the Vedic literature itself. So children used to be sent to forest hermitages. Mostly these forest schools were run by retired householders. Retired householders means those who have already lived a purposeful life, trained their children, have made sure of their continuity of the family lineage, will retire to a forest hermitage, husband and wife, and spend the rest of their lifetime spreading and teaching and imparting Vedic education. So, here is a convocation address, which is addressed to a group of students who are returning from a Vedic school. They are on their way back home, and they will marry, they become householders, they will play their multiple roles, husband, wife, sons or daughters, and citizens of the country, or responsible members of society, and so on. The convocation address is this: Veda Manuchi Acharya Andevasina Manushasti. After teaching the Vedas, the teacher addresses the students, the assembly of students. Satyam Bada Dharmam Chara Swadhyayan Ma Pramadaha Acharya Priyam Dhanamahruti Prajatantu Ma Vivachesihi Satyana Pramadavyam Dharmana Pramadavyam Kushalana Pramadavyam Bhutina Pramadavyam Swadhyaya Pravajana Bhyamna Pramadavyam Deva Pitragarya Bhyamna Pramadavyam Madhur Devo Bhava Pidur Devo Bhava Acharya Devo Bhava Aditi Devo Bhava. This is the first paragraph of this instruction. The instruction begins like this. First you should speak the truth, and then you should practice dharma, and then never give up learning what you learned in the forest hermitage school. You should reinforce and further enrich by continuing your education after leaving the school. You should never deviate from the path of truthfulness, righteousness, and also you should respect your parents, you should respect your teachers, and you should respect the guests. These are some very fundamental instructions given. So Matru Devo Bhava, literally if you read the Upanishad translation, be one to whom the mother is God. This is literal translation. The implication is, you should have the same reverence to your mother and father, to your teacher and a guest who comes to your home, to visit your home accidentally. That's why, you know, a guest is not somebody who comes to your home after making a long appointment beforehand. Guest is somebody who may happens to visit your home. Ancient times, if you want to get an example, if you read Wayfarer Pilgrim, the great Russian mystical work belonging to the mid-19th century, you find a pilgrim, he travels, and as he travels, he finds that he is welcomed by total strangers, welcomed to their homes, given food and lodging for 3 days, and when he goes back, he is given bread and given some money because he is on his way to Jerusalem. That's I don't want to go those details. So if you read the Way of a Pilgrim, you find maybe in the Russian Orthodox mystical tradition, this was very much a practice. The pilgrims used to be honored and protected and given welcome and hospitality by householders. So these are some of the instructions given to householders. Now remember, these are not instructions which have a deep spiritual implication in the Vedantic sense. These are instructions with the deep spiritual implications in everyday life. How an householder, husband and wife, son or daughter, uncle or nephew, or niece, how they should conduct themselves, and how they should practice these higher values, which are certainly, no doubt, spiritual values, how they should be practiced in their everyday life situations. Now, this may naturally lead us to another question. What were the fundamental values that guided the life of an householder? Society, social life in Vedic times. There were 4 fundamental values. In Sanskrit, they are called dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. 4 values. 2 values are goals, 2 values are the means. Dharma and moksha are goals, artha and kama are the means. So, dharma means certain ethical, moral, spiritual values that should guide our conduct in our everyday life situations when we are engaged in our so-called secular activities, business, paying taxes, dealing with the responsibilities within the family structure, family situation, how to be an ideal son, ideal daughter, ideal father, ideal mother, and so on. Well, we will go to those examples in course of time. So, this dharma should be a guiding principle in our everyday pursuit of secular goals and performing secular duties and responsibilities. And artha and kama, artha means the means, the resources that we need, like money, wealth, status, and so on. These are requirements for householders. Householders were not expected to practice external renunciation. Householders were expected to practice only internal renunciation. If householders who include wealth, who include people who generate wealth for the society, who defend the society, who support the society, if they practice asceticism and poverty, that will lead to degeneration of society. So you can see a very intelligent scheme. Householders should generate wealth, should resist the evil, if necessary, using violence. Gandhian non-violence pacifism was not a part of Vedic culture. That's something that I want to drive home. Actually, Gandhi himself said that he modified some of these teachings to suit the immediate need of resisting the British rule, and he partly got this idea from Jaina religion, which is a kind of extreme practice of non-violence and inaction. So, in Vedic tradition, an householder should become wealthy, generate wealth using proper ethical means. An householder has a duty and responsibility to resist the evil, even when using violence. That's an important message in the Mahabharata you find. Where Lord Krishna says, Aknido garada shaiva shastravani dhanabha kshetradara apahartacha shadaydeki atatayinaka. This is one quotation from Yajnavalkya's document. Those of you who are lawyers will be surprised. India had 10 constitutions that predate 2nd century BC. All the smritis, you know, Vyasa Smriti, Yajnavalkya Smriti, Parasara Smriti, Narada Smriti, Jabala Smriti, all the Smriti is nothing but a set of constitutional documents teach with instructions on how to practice Vedic values in different life situations. So you find Nripa Dharma, Kshatriya Dharma, Brahmana Dharma, Chhatra Dharma. So you find the response, the duties and responsibilities of a ruler, of a farmer, of a soldier, of a student, of a teacher, of a mother, of a father, Pidridharma, Madhridharma. You find long discussions in many of these 10 constitutional documents. And the latest of those documents go back to 2nd century BC, according to many. The oldest one belongs to maybe 11th century BC. That is called Vyasa Smriti. Sometimes called. Sometimes Manu Smriti and Vyasa Smriti are both are considered to be equally old. So, in many of the Smriti texts, the ancient Indian Sanskrit constitutions, you find these great statements, how to be an ideal administrator. Those of you are interested, Warren Hastings took over the administration of Bengal in 1757 after the Battle of Plassey, he became the first Governor General. He invited a group of Hindu Pandits from Benares. They all came to Calcutta, and they codified these 10 smritis with the help of Hindu Pandits and the translators. And that was how Hindu Civil Code came into existence, which was incorporated into Indian Constitution in 1854 or so. I mean, about 7 years after India got independence. So this will be of interest. So even now, even till about 30, 40 years back, great respectable judges and lawyers used to be trained in many of the ancient smritis, which are the old constitutional documents. So many of these smritis tell you this, that is, a person who comes to attack you, a person who does injury or does harm to society, to women folk, to the weak, setting fire to homes, or killing people by poisoning water and so on, They should be killed without a second thought. That's a Atatayanam Ayantam Hanya Deva Avichare. You know, Avichare means without a second thought. Hanyad. So capital punishment was essentially enforced for people who did terrible crimes to society, who caused injury to vast populations, who created problems, who threatened to do harm to the weak, defenseless, the women folk, and so on. You can find these great statements in the Hindu civil court, which of course now is no more part of the regular constitution. Indian constitution took many of these ideas from Hindu civil court and from the ancient statements. Now, what I'm going to say is this. So, in many of these ancient books, you find some of the duties and responsibilities of an household and different life situations. Even there are rules and regulations for property succession. They could Ayakarma, Yajnavalkya Smriti, and the commentaries are elaborate discussions on property succession and so on. Now, these were the four values, but one point was insisted that all your efforts to acquire wealth and to acquire the strength and the resources to defend society, to enforce law, even for a king or an administrator was not expected to deviate from the path of dharma. Dharma was the guiding principle. So once you stick to dharma, one day you may reach a higher level of your own spiritual and cultural evolution, and then you will start thinking of something higher and transcendental. It is called moksha or spiritual liberation. These are four values that actually shaped Hindu civilization in short. Now, there are just a few important aspects regarding everyday life which I am going to discuss. One important aspect of ancient Hindu social and family life was adherence to 16 rituals. It called 16 samskaras. Samskara means sacrament. It's an integral part of Vedic tradition. So every individual has to go through these 16 sacraments. It's called samskaras. These samskaras were sometimes expanded to 40. Those who led a very ascetic and rigid way of life, spending their whole lifetime to study the Vedas, to practice meditation and contemplation. For them, there were not 16, but 40 samskaras to be practiced in their life. So these sacraments begin, the first samskaras begin before you are born. And the last one is setting fire to your dead body, antyashti. So these are 16 samskaras for the majority of people. So these samskaras, I don't want to go into detail, garbhadhanam, pumsavanam, simantodayanam, jatakarma, namakaranam, and so on. In fact, I don't want to go through the whole list. I mean, before a child is born, husband and wife should pray, should practice certain spiritual vows, and then he should be given food after offering to God. He should be given a name. It's all as a ritual. And then he should be given food first. And then he should be introduced to Vedic studies and Gayatri through sacred ceremony, Upanayanam, and so on. And at the end of the Vedic education, there's another ceremony, all this. But the most important ceremony in the life of an ordinary household was Vivaha, which is sometimes mentioned at 14th or 15th, the second is called marriage ceremony. It was constitute a very, very important ceremony in Hindu tradition, Hindu ancient Vedic civilization. It's called a Grihastha Ashrama. Because an householder was a key figure in Vedic tradition. Many people who have no access, unfortunately, to the original Vedic literature, get away with the impression that Hinduism or Vedas means you growing a long beard and long hair and sitting under a tree meditating on God. That was not the whole of Vedic civilization. Vedic civilization was not a kind of ascetic civilization. It was a well-balanced civilization. It gave equal importance to the needs and requirements and responsibilities and status of householders. How an householder should practice the secular duties and responsibilities with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. Once they attach a sense of sanctity and sacredness to their secular duties and responsibilities, it becomes a samskara, it becomes a sacrament. So, I can say a few important important principles regarding householder's life. There is a funny statement in the Vedic literature. It says, the normal human tendencies, actions and behavior patterns won't require a book to guide them. See, you walk with your feet, you eat food when you are hungry, you drink water when you are thirsty, you wear something when it is too cold, and so on. For that you don't need a book. You don't need a guidance. You don't need a teacher. But to do all this in a civilized, cultured, refined manner, without deviating from the path of dharma, you need a structure of values. So, ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha samanya medat pasubhir naranam dharmohitesham adhigo vishesha dharmena hina pasubhisamana. What it means is, food, sleep, all these are common for animals and also for human beings. But there is a special privilege, which is a special privilege, a prerogative of human beings. What is that? Dharmohitesham adhigo visheshaha. One special privilege, a special characteristic, which only human beings can claim and boast of, is dharma. So he says, dharmena hinaha pasubhissamanaha. Those who do not practice this value of dharma, they are not different from animals. A very cruel, rather cruel statement. So that's why even the sacraments, the responsibilities and duties of an householder had a spiritual orientation. Now, for example, I can give one example. In Hindu marriage custom, which in some ways may have some similarities with the Catholic marriage rituals, once a group of Western devotees visited Holy Mother, Sri Sarada Devi. So, Mother was the mother, anyone who saw Mother or read about Mother felt Mother was the mother of whole humanity. So they felt so much of intimate respect and reverence for Mother. And Mother also showed the same affection for these Western visitors. They did not know each other's language. That's something very important. But Mother wanted to know something about their marriage rituals. So one of the Western disciples, Western devotees, explained the Catholic rituals, marriage ceremony. And Mother was highly pleased. So the idea of husband and wife undertaking a spiritual journey, a pilgrimage, that idea, you find in the ancient Vedic rituals. So I can quote one. Pani grahana mantraha niyadam daru lakshanam tesham tu vijnayar vidyudbhi saptame pade. That is, The purpose of marriage is for the husband and wife to undertake a spiritual journey for a common purpose, going through the path of artha and kama, fulfillment of secular goals, duties and responsibilities, without deviating from the path of dharma, eventually reaching moksha. Moksha means spiritual enlightenment. So that this shows that the main purpose of marriage ceremony is not physical relationship alone, but rather it was a lifelong companionship, a mutual help and cooperation in, as a spiritual pilgrimage, in the common spiritual pilgrimage. So you find such ideas. So Saptame Pade, you know, they go around the fire ritually, in ritual manner. So it was considered to be a symbolic presentation of a pilgrimage. So even the ordinary secular activities were given a sense of sanctity and sacredness by giving a spiritual orientation. So it is a pilgrimage together through the path of artha and kama, is being fully established in the path of dharma, righteousness, eventually reaching the goal of spiritual enlightenment, spiritual liberation called moksha. So this was how these four values were integrated. Again, the relationship between a father and son, the relationship between a teacher and a disciple. So here is a quotation from Brahma Vaivarta Purana. It says, Yatha putra tatha shishyaha na veda putra shishyayohu tarpane pindadanecha palane pariposhane. So yatha putra tatha shishyaha. A teacher, an ideal teacher, has to look upon his student with the same affection, with the same sense of responsibility with which he should look upon his own son. This idea behind. So there was a funny statement, Sarvatra Jayam Icheda Shishyan Iched Parajayam. An ideal teacher should dream of being defeated by his own disciple. I don't think many modern teachers will go that far, how even the most daring teachers will welcome being defeated by his own students. There are many cases, including Indian IITs, where children commit suicide because their PhD thesis was stolen by their research guides. This happened everywhere, all over India, all over the world you find. So the ancient scripture tells you that Sarvatra Jayam Icheda, the greatness of a teacher is demonstrated when he dreams of being defeated, for finding himself at a disadvantage in comparison with his student. His student should excel even more than he himself. Similarly, an ideal father should be able to enjoy when his own son excels him. So you can find this, this is deeply spiritual. In fact, when you attach a sense of sanctity and a spiritual sacredness to ordinary human relationship, whether between a husband and wife, as you find in the Saptapadi, this ceremony, you know. So also in the relationship between a father and son, and father and daughter, the same meaning, you know. You should remember the Vedic tradition boasts of at least 16 or 17 women saints and philosophers. Some of the greatest philosophical teachers and exponents of Vedanta were women in Vedic times. Women also were allowed to study the Vedas. You can imagine, even in 14th century, 13th century in England, people used to be persecuted for owning a Bible in English. You can imagine. Many of the Protestant, non-Catholic rebels, were burnt at stake, were persecuted. Normally, there will be competition between different denominations within the Protestant church. It's our privilege to burn him. So you find when Servetus, the Spanish Protestant, was burned, actually, Calvin wanted the privilege for himself, but he didn't get it for translating the Bible into Czechoslovakian language. So what I mean to say, in ancient Vedic times, there were women who were formally initiated the study of the Vedas, including Gayatri Mantra, and also some of them were outstanding scholars of Vedanta. But remember, you had in ancient society, we are talking about maybe a time at least 3,500 years before Christ, at 3,500 BC. During the later centuries and later millennia, many things happened in Hindu society, and as a result of this, many of these higher values were completely lost. I can give an example. You heard, when you read Indian newspapers, you read and hear about dowry system. You don't hear, many of you must have heard. The parents of the bride will have to pay huge amount of money to the husband. Now, there are statements going back to 3000 BC where it is said that a father who expressed dowry for his son's marriage is the worst sinner. I can quote something. Yo manushyaha sugam putram vikriya dhanimichadi. That means a person, a father, who wants to sell his son for a huge amount of money in the form of dowry. It is still happening in this 21st century. So it shows the degeneration. We have walked backward from Vedic times. If you go to Vedic times, Vedic age, it was a sublime civilization. It is not an utopian presentation. That's one of the reasons why, in spite of the fact that many of my friends sitting in front of me may not understand the Sanskrit quotation which I'm quoting, I insisted on quoting this right in front of you, because I'm quoting the original scriptures here. For example, in the Mahabharata and the Anushasana Parva, you find here, Yo manushyaha sugam putram vikriya dhanam ichchadi kanyam va jivitarthaya yaha shuklena prayachadi saptavare mahaghore niraye kalaswakaye swedam mutram mutram purisham cha tasmin mudha samasnude. If I translate literally, I would use many tabooed expressions, which I won't do that. It says, a father who expects money from the bride's parents for the son's marriage will go to the lowest and most horrible hell, where he will be surrounded by all the extrita, all the despicable things that he would like to be away from. In short, using the most moderate language possible. So there's a mahaghori, mean terrible, terrible hell. The one who sells his own father, his own son. Selling some is a metaphor. He arranges his son's marriage expecting a dowry from the bride's parents. And that will ensure that this father, mother is not mentioned, only father is the more aggressive one. This father will go down to the most horrible, the most sinful hellfire. That is the statement which comes here. So, but then, parents also have a sacred duty and responsibility. Parents who push their children to work hard and go to MIT, driving them practically crazy very often, as happens today. Parents who put too much of pressure on their children, spending too much money, pampering too much, or throwing them out when they reach the 17th year. Both are equally despicable. That's one stage, you know. Gururna sasyat, sujanona sasyat. Pidana sasya janinina sasya. If a teacher, a father or mother who do not ensure, who do not give value education to their children, that person is neither teacher nor father nor mother. That means a teacher who doesn't teach spiritual values, cultural values, who doesn't equip his students with the necessary wisdom to manage and to handle whatever information he gets from the teacher, or a mother or a father who do not teach higher spiritual values to their children, they cannot be called either father, mother, or teacher. That's why, you know, guru na sasyat, sujana na sasyat, pidana sasyat, janani na sasyat. Those who know the Sanskrit will enjoy it. That guru is not a guru who doesn't teach spiritual values to the students. That father is not an ideal father who only teaches secular values, who only teaches son to succeed in this material life, who doesn't impart spiritual values. And that mother who doesn't impart spiritual values to her son, she is not mother, and father is not father, a teacher is not an ideal teacher. Very cruel statement, but we can see the fanatical sincerity of these ancient Vedic teachers. And also it gives a glimpse into the sublime beauty and charm and a sheer grandeur of that ancient Vedic civilization. Now, people may ask this question, these are all, we cannot imagine that these books which I am quoting from were written over a period of thousands of years. They could not have written all this from out of imagination. If you read the Ramayana and Mahabharata, all the mythological books and classical works, you can find wonderful characters who embody all these values. Now, we should remember that a classical work, whether a novel or a poem or a short story, more correctly, accurately reflect the real life situation of a society than a book of history. A book of history is just a dead list of events. But if you read, for example, Tolstoy's War and Peace, you get the whole picture of life as it existed in 19th century Europe, life as it existed in 19th century Russia, in France, you can read. So if you read creative writings, if you read Old Testament, you get a more accurate picture of life in those ancient lands and civilizations than a book of history. So if you read the Mahabharata, if you read the Ramayana, if you read all this Bhagavata Purana, you are not just reading mythological books. People dismiss these books as mythologies. Mythologies reflect more accurately the real life of society, the pulse of society, social life, than any history book ever can. So, I just give you just a few examples. Now I shall come to the fourth value, moksha, then I will conclude. So the most important value, this transcendental value of Vedic civilization was moksha. Dharma, there is the regulating value, the value that guides life in all its various aspects. Especially the life of an householder. How he should be or she should be an ideal father, mother, sister, brother, whatever may be. What should be an ideal teacher, ideal mother, and so on. Now, how do you really stick to the principle of dharma? How do you fight the temptation to be a pragmatist or a utilitarian? Because why should you practice dharma? The question arises. The foundation of dharma ideal is to be found in the ideal of moksha. So the Vedic civilization tells you, the teachers in those days, they taught their students that if you live your secular life without deviating from the path of dharma or righteousness, you will reach a point, you will reach a higher level of cultural evolution. Then you realize the transitoriness, the impermanence of all the secular achievements, all the material enjoyments that you may already have accumulated. And then you will start thinking of something transcendental, something permanent, and that ideally is linked to moksha or mukti. So there were two fundamental concepts of spiritual enlightenment or liberation in Vedic civilization. It's called mukti. Mukti means liberation. Moksha, another word. According to some Vedic teachers, those who are highly evolved in spiritual life can remain spiritually liberated even while living in this world, even while doing the duties and the responsibilities of an householder going through different life situations. A mother, so you find in Mahabharata, a butcher is teaching a monk. You find a Mahabharata, Vyadha Gita. So very, you find if you read the Mahabharata, and there are 18 mythological books called Mahapuranas and another 18 called Upapuranas, subsidiary mythological books. Total altogether, 18 great mythological works called Puranas and 18 secondary Puranas. And plus Bhagavata and others. Mahabharata, which is more than 100,000 verses. You will come across hundreds of dialogues between saints and sages, between philosophers, kings, and so on. Now, two types of liberation are mentioned. One type of liberation, anyone can be liberated even while living in this world, even while going through different life situations. You can, as I mentioned in the Mahabharata, there is an interesting dialogue. A saint and his teacher, the teacher who expounds the biggest, the great, highest Vedanta philosophy, is by profession a butcher. When he was young, he went to forest and studied and meditated and contemplated. But his father was a butcher. There was no other secular job that he had learned. He came back to his village and continued his job. So don't ever imagine that spiritual liberation means sitting somewhere far away inside a cave or maybe in a forest. No. An householder or a housewife, in Mahabharata you find the story also includes one housewife who was also an enlightened person. You find many such stories. Even in the Mahabharata itself, one of the wisest characters is Gandhari. He is the mother of all the villains of Mahabharata. You know, the Kauravas, the 100 evil characters you find. Another one is Kunti, the mother of Pandavas. So, and they were all highly enlightened people. So, spiritual enlightenment doesn't mean that you should get away from social obligations. Anyone can be liberated. One given example, such people are called Jivan Mukta, or Sadhyo Mukti, or Jivan Mukti. One example, those of you who have read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna may remember, frequently it happened that some unknown strangers came to Dakshineswar temple. Once a gentleman came, he was not following any conventional dress code, that much to say. He looked like a madman. But he was an enlightened person. Sri Ramakrishna asked his nephew, Hriday, go after him and find him. And that man happened to be an enlightened person. He came to the Dakshineswar. For him, the whole world was a reflection of the transcendental reality. There was nowhere to run away from, because every day, every moment, he was enjoying the presence of the divine reality, divine presence of God within him and everywhere. So, Such people, Nityotsvam Bhavatyesham Nityasri Nityamangalam. For such enlightened people, every day, every moment, every act is an occasion for celebration. Well, those of you who are interested, those who have read, again I can quote, we have a pilgrim. When the pilgrim learned Jesus prayer from a Christian, from a Russian Orthodox monk in a cell, the first experience he had, he felt a great compassion for the whole world. He felt a great joy because he felt the presence of Jesus everywhere and in his own life. I'm giving him one example from a non-Vedantic tradition. That means it is so universal. Such great enlightened men, they are already enlightened, they are already liberated. They live in the world, but they are not actually living in the world. Physically, they are living in the world. Mentally, they are living in close proximity. They are living in the world of the spirit, the divine. Such great men and women who are liberated used to be called Jivan Muktas. The other school was known as the school of Krama Mukti. Krama means gradual. You read the scriptures, you listen to lectures, then you slowly try to practice these great values. You do your work without any selfish motive. You practice all ethical, moral values, non-attachment, love and compassion, non-violence, freedom from greed, all these values, yamas and niyamas. And that will gradually help you to realize this divine truth within you. It's called Krama Mukti. Krama. So I don't want to go further into this because time is over. But just I want to conclude with this statement. So there was also this concept of mendicancy. I mean, taking sannyasa. So you can find when you are a young man or a young girl, you study the Vedas. Then you become an householder. Then when you get old enough to feel that you don't have to do anything more to look after your family, you retire to forest hermitage. So an interesting statement, Manusmriti. See, he says, Grihastasu yada pasyet vali palidam atmanaha apatyasi apatyam tadaranyam samasyet. Manusmriti says, an householder, when his hair gets gray, when his face gets wrinkled, he should not try to get back to youth again or artificially. Rather, he should retire to forest hermitage and spend the rest of his or her lifetime, husband and wife together, studying the scriptures, imparting education. All the Vedic education was continued and preserved by these great teachers of forest hermitages, mostly retired householders. So you find, so this is called Vanaprasthasama. Beyond that, when they actually reach a point of higher spiritual enlightenment, they can take to formal sannyasa mendicancy. So, you find in the Vedic tradition, in the Vedic literature, many such great men and women who went through these four stages of spiritual life. But then, it was also true that if a young person who doesn't want to go through these four stages, suppose a young man says, a young person says, I don't want to live the life of an householder or anything, I want to live a spiritual life. You can think of Paul Brunton, who happened to read something about Ravana Maharshi and went all the way to India and stayed. Fine. So people happening there. The many Westerners, you find it, the long beard, you find wandering all over the Himalayas. You find such people. Many of them young also. So those who do not want to go through these gradual cycles, these stages of evolution, they can take to a life of mendicancy anytime. Shankaracharya became a monk when he should have gone to kindergarten. And he had already written all the greatest books in Sanskrit Vedantic tradition before he pass the 12th grade or maybe 9th grade. He had completed all his writings and teachings by the time he was 16 years old. And he had already become a monk when he was less than 7 years. Suppose you ask a Shankaracharya, a man like Shankaracharya, no, you should marry, then you get old, when you get head, then you take to mendicancy. The world will not get a great spiritual genius. Vivekananda, he also became a monk when he was very a young man. He passed away by the time, before he reached the 39th year. So, you find such examples. That's why Brahmacharyam Parisamapya Grihi Bhaved, Grihi Bhutva Vani Bhaved, Vani Bhutva Pravrajet. These four statements comes from the Jabala Upanishad. You also find Vajrasujiga Upanishad, Narada Prayavrajiga Upanishad. Four Upanishads mention this statement. You know, Brahmacharyam Parisamapya Grihi Bhaved, Grihi Bhutva Vani Bhaved. Means, first you go to forest hermitage, or maybe you can learn from your own father in your home. And after that, after learning, after finishing your education, Vedic education, you should learn those skills that make you, that will help you to become an ideal householder. And then you enter the life of an householder. And then after finishing your duties and responsibilities of an householder, I mean, you should see the face of a grandson or granddaughter. That's the Manu statement. That means if lineage will be preserved, then you should not remain at home supervising everything, becoming a pest to your own grandchildren. Go to forest hermitage. Spend the rest of your lifetime contemplation and meditation. And then eventually go to higher transcendental idea. Now these four stages of life, they represent such a sublime and exhaust you and comprehends you scheme of human existence. Yadiva idaratha brahmacharya deva pravarjet grihadva vanadva punaravrdiva. That means not only that, if a little child wants to become a monk because he or she is not interested in going through these regular stages of being a householder and so on, he can straight away become a mendicant. Take to active spiritual life. So, it was a very exhaustive, very comprehensive, and very rational and very scientific. Remember, it was so universal. It is so non-denominational. These four stages of human life and human existence are universal, have universal implications for all times. Even today, especially the ideal of the art of graceful retirement. How to retire gracefully from active life? Well, I don't have any more duties and responsibilities. And then when you do something, it will be for the good of whole humanity. When you don't consider something as your own duty and responsibility, then whatever you do will be for the good of others. No one will keep quiet. It's impossible physically and mentally to remain quiet all the time. So this ideal of gradual ascent from one stage to another stage, this path of cultural and spiritual evolution, this is a unique feature of Vedic civilization. So if you have anything to ask, I'll be happy to respond to your question during the interaction. Thank you. No, I will do the concluding. Om Dyau Shanti Randariksham Shanti Prithivi Shanti Apashanti Roshadaya Shanti Vanaspataya Shanti Vishvedeva Shanti Brahma Shanti Sarvam Shanti Shanti Reva Shanti Sama Shanti Redhi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.